The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 16th of September 2021 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing. We are live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Chris Chermak. Coming up on today's programme...
Today, we join our nations in a next-generation partnership. And so, friends, AUKUS is born. A new enhanced trilateral security partnership between Australia, the United Kingdom, and the United States.
Australia's Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, hails his country's nuclear-powered security pact. We'll explore the significance with insights straight from Canberra and London. And then the economist Carsten Brzeski will tell us why reports of rising inflation in Germany and in Europe are greatly exaggerated. We'll also bring you the latest installment of our Canadian election series, and it's Thursday, which means Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be here with me in the studio for his global pop countdown. Any teasers, Faye?
Hello, Chris. Today we're going to a country that had a very recent election, and they also have a burgeoning scene in hip-hop.
That's a lot of teasers. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Chris Chermak. The Biden administration's efforts to counter Chinese dominance in Asia and support allies in the region is gathering steam. This week, the US, UK and Australia agreed a landmark security pact in the Indo-Pacific. The move will see Australia build nuclear-powered submarines for the first time. The pact will also cover artificial intelligence, cyber and quantum technologies. So what does all this mean for Australia? Monocle's contributor in Canberra, Artie Bedigeri, sent us this report.
The news that Australia is going to be getting nuclear-powered submarines came out of the blue. 5 years ago, we signed an agreement with the French to provide us with diesel-powered submarines. It has since become clear that this technology would not be adequate to meet security challenges. Plus, they wouldn't be delivered for almost 20 years. At the same time, a new security partnership between Australia, the US and UK was announced, called AUKUS. All of this is pretty big news, even if you're not someone to spend a lot of time thinking about submarines. The full details haven't yet been announced, but it is clear that it's all about sending a strong message to China. Tensions between Australia and China have been increasing over the past few years. So this deal is all about Australia proving to Beijing that it has big and powerful allies that it can rely on. But it will get Australia offside with other friends. New Zealand and Pacific countries are avowedly anti-nuclear. New Zealand has already said it won't allow the subs in its waters. Australia is a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, so we can expect that IAEA inspectors will be in our doorsteps wanting access. And China has put out a statement saying it's irresponsible. The big questions now are, does this tacitly say that Australia is undoubtedly in a Cold War situation with China? And just how much safer will Australia now be? For Monocle 24, I'm Archie Bettigary.
Thanks very much, Artie. Let's get more on this now with Michael Clark. He's the former head of the Royal United Services Institute here in London. Michael, thanks so much for joining us today. I mean, this pact has been described as historic, one of the biggest since World War II. We heard from Artie there about what's in this for Australia. What is in it for the US and the UK?
Well, for the United Kingdom in particular, it's the UK bit of this AUKUS that is the most interesting thing politically, because Australia and the United States could have whatever relationship they wanted. I mean, Australia could always turn to the US, as it has been doing in other respects. It's bringing the UK into it, which is most interesting, actually, because this plays to the global Britain claim that the government makes. And also it links Australia into a, as it were, a global group. It isn't just Australia and Washington, it's Australia and London and Washington. So as your correspondent said, that sends a message to China. It also gives Britain a big boost to the whole global Britain claim, although it will enrage the French and it will do Britain some diplomatic damage, I think, in Europe. But it proves to our partners that you've got to keep on taking Britain seriously. You might be enraged by Brexit, but you can't just ignore Britain. And this is a big tactical gain for the British government. And they were very happy to announce it late last night. Boris Johnson was extremely upbeat about it. So was the Ministry of Defence. But it will take some smoothing over. You know, in a way, we've outflanked many of our European friends, and particularly France, in order to make this arrangement with Australia. And a lot of people will say that this is provocative and that China will take a dim view of it, and it'll make life harder for security in the Pacific. That's a big talking point.
Well, it's very interesting how you describe that. I mean, what's then the Biden administration's motivation, if I can say, why pick the UK over, say, France, which also had actually a submarine deal with Australia? What's their motivation?
Some of its speed, because the French deal was going quite slowly. And I mean, you can understand the frustration in Paris. I mean, Australia had been saying to France for years, we don't want an SSM, we don't want a nuclear powered sub, we want diesel electric. And then they come to Britain and America and say, well, you know, we'll go with you to give us an SSN, to give us a nuclear powered submarine. So I can understand France's frustration. They could have had an SSN from France if they'd wanted, but they're going with a British American arrangement. Now, it'll take about 18 months for the Australians to decide what sort of design they want. They might just take something off the shelf from America, which might be, if it was American, it would be the Virginia class SSN, the Virginia class nuclear submarine. If they take it from Britain, it'd be the Astute class. My guess is it will be the Astute class, because it's a bit closer to what the Australians probably want, and its own development phase is closer to getting going again, gearing up in the shipyard at Adelaide. Almost certainly the Australians will build the hull, they'll build a submarine themselves, but the designs of it and quite a lot of the fit out will be from either America or from Britain, and I suspect it'll be the Astute design from Britain that will probably be most prevalent in whatever Australia produces. But these submarines won't be in the water, or more to the point under the water, until the end of the decade in the early 2030s. What's more interesting before that is the idea of collaboration on some pretty key technologies. Artificial intelligence was mentioned, cybersecurity was mentioned, and most importantly of all, quantum computing, which is the philosopher's stone of modern technology. And if these three countries are going to collaborate on those things, plus a number of other undersea sensor technologies, then that does represent a big step forward in trilateral collaboration between them.
And Michael, just quickly, China wasn't mentioned directly in the announcement, which was interesting perhaps in itself. But Beijing's reaction, of course, has been swift, calling this irresponsible and accusing Washington and its allies of a Cold War mentality. Is that fair?
Well, it's absolutely predictable. It's all about China, of course it is. And this is only one of a number of ad hoc security arrangements that have been springing up throughout the Indo-Pacific region in response to China's growing military power and China's political attitudes, which are extremely uncompromising. So, yes, I mean, what we're seeing is, after a decade of Chinese global assertiveness, increasing assertiveness, we're now seeing the pushback. And this is what you'd expect in world politics. After about a decade of being diplomatically aggressive, other powers start to push back against it. This is only one of a number of examples.
Thank you very much, Michael, for your insights. That was the security expert Michael Clark. Now here's Monocle's Emma Searle with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Chris. The United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, has urged education authorities to reopen schools as soon as possible in countries where millions of students are still not allowed to return to classrooms because of the pandemic. UNICEF says schools in around 17 countries remain fully closed. The favourite to become Japan's next Prime Minister, Taro Kono, has said that any new economic stimulus measures should prioritise spending on renewable energy and expansion of 5G networks. Kono is running to replace Yoshihide Suga, who is stepping down as leader of the ruling Liberal Democratic Party. The Bulgarian president, Rumen Radev, has reappointed incumbent caretaker premier, Stefan Yanev, to lead an interim administration until a new government is formed. The EU state will hold its third parliamentary elections this year after inconclusive polls in April and July failed to produce a government. And Milan's busy late summer of trade fairs continues this weekend as the Italian city's art show Mirat rolls into town. It comes hot on the heels of the Super Salone. Find out more by heading to monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Chris.
Thank you very much, Emma. Inflation has long been well known to people in Germany more than most. Memories of the Weimar Republic of the 1920s are kept alive in the minds of citizens and in the German media. This week, the European Central Bank ran out of patience with those comparisons. Isabel Schnabel, a German board member of the Central Bank, called out the German media for unnecessarily rousing people's fears of rising consumer prices today. Is she right? Or should we be worried about the rising cost of everything from energy to food in the aftermath of the global pandemic? For more on this, we are joined on the line by Carsten Brzeski. He's the global head of macro at ING Research. Carsten, thanks very much for joining us on the line. Consumer prices are rising at a pretty fast clip, it's fair to say. The Bundesbank in Germany says they could rise as much as 5% this year, and also in the rest of Europe for that matter. I mean, should we be worried?
Well, I think to some extent we should be worried. This is not a return of the Weimar Republic, like you mentioned, but we should be worried because this is 4 or 5% inflation. This is something that everyone really feels in his or her pockets. And the big controversy right now is, will this all be over next year? This is what the European Central Bank is telling us, that it is all a one-off. They now mention it, or call this a hump-shaped inflation development. And next year we'll see inflation rates drop back to normal levels. But I think there are also other views out there saying that this could be an era of somewhat higher inflation than what we saw over the last 10 years.
Well, I mean, and what impact has the pandemic had in that sense? It's such a unique thing. And obviously, we didn't see a big rise in consumer prices last year. I mean, in that sense, you know, maybe the ECB could be right that it's a one-off, do you feel? Or how much of an impact has the pandemic had?
Well, when we talk about inflation rates, 4%, 5%, it currently a lot comes from the pandemic. And, you know, start with energy prices. Energy prices were extremely low during the pandemic because there was this huge economic shock. There was no demand. And also producers reduced the energy or even broader commodity supply. Well, then all of a sudden, lockdowns ended. Huge global demand picking up again. And producers of commodities simply couldn't catch up with high demand. This pushes up prices. This should be transitory, as the ECB calls it. Then we have this, what I would call the post-lockdown inflation, namely first producers, especially in the hospitality sector, asking higher prices, maybe to make up some losses of the last 18 months. Maybe it is just in order to, you know, to whatever, compensate for the additional costs they had to make their business COVID-proof. So this is all corona-driven. But the question now is, for how long will these inflationary pressures remain in the system, the economy? And there we know that that currently producers seem to be extremely willing to pass on higher production costs to consumers. These are the so-called second round effects. Also, when you look at wage developments, very well behaved up to now. But we had the first unions in Germany, for example, demanding a 5% salary increase. So we see that there could also be a second round effect on wages, which then should push up inflation also next year, not at the level of 4 or 5%, but clearly higher than the 1% we had prior to the crisis.
And Carsten, Germany, as we talked about, does have a unique relationship with inflation given its past. I mean, what is your sense? Does the media play a role in sort of furthering this narrative? And is that a problem? I mean, sometimes inflation can also become a self-fulfilling prophecy in that sense.
Well, at least when you follow the conservative media, they are clearly pushing this nightmare, this national trauma of hyperinflation story. Yeah? And I think this has to do, one, with the hyperinflation story, but also especially in the conservative part of Germany with almost built-in skepticism, criticism of everything that the European Central Bank has done over the last 20 years, particularly since Mario Draghi took over, and now in the views or in the eyes of these German conservatives, Christine Lagarde is doing the same thing, namely flooding the economy with extremely cheap money in order to help the southern European economies. And this is, I think, the short version. Yes, and it can have an impact because, first of all, it undermines the credibility of a central bank. Second of all, it means that inflation expectations could go up as well if the Germans start to believe these stories from the conservative media, namely that we are really at the eve of a kind of permanent runaway inflation. So therefore, it is dangerous. Plus, it increases the political pressure on a central bank. I think it is good to have a discussion on the substance, to have a discussion also with the ECB on how do they look at the economy. You know, could they be wrong as we are in such an unprecedented situation? Maybe their economic models don't show the new reality. I think this could be a discussion, but let's be clear, economics is not a real science, so no one really knows what inflation is going to do, neither the conservative German media nor the ECB.
Nobody knows, but we know we will continue to follow this story. Carsten, thank you very much for joining us. That was Carsten Brzeski at ING Research. You are listening to The Briefing here on Monocle 24.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine, a global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine. Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. For 20 years, Novartis has been at the forefront in the battle to eliminate malaria, developing innovative therapies and new ways to provide access to healthcare. Together with international partners, the company has delivered more than 1 billion treatment courses of combination therapy and has contributed to reduce malaria deaths by nearly half since the millennium. Combination therapy is today's standard of care, and Novartis supplies more than 90% of its treatment without profit to malaria endemic countries. Dr. Caroline Bolton is the development head within Novartis, tasked with leading the charge for the next wave of innovative treatments for malaria. Caroline Bolton, thanks for being with us. Tell us more about how Novartis and its partners are continuing to innovate to ensure future treatment options are available and remain effective.
We actually made a $100 million commitment to malaria back in 2018, and that's really paying dividends now. We have four next generation malaria programs up and running, featuring three compounds with novel mechanisms of action, and they're really showing highly promising anti-malarial activity. We have CAF-156, which is also known as Ganaplacide. It belongs to a novel class of compounds that act against both the blood stage infection and liver stage infection. So it also has the potential perhaps to give a little prophylactic activity as well, which would be really useful as we move towards elimination. It's combined with a new formulation of lumefantrine. We always have to partner malaria drugs to address the threat of resistance. But that new formulation of lumefantrine allows us to give the drug perhaps once daily rather than traditional two or three times daily over just 2 or 3 days. This combination is just completing phase two of development, and we hope to be able to commence the confirmatory efficacy studies within the next year or so. We also have another agent, KE609, which is also known as cipargamin. And that holds real promise because it shows the fastest killing activity against parasites of any anti-malarial that's been seen to date. And that obviously offers a real potential for use in severe malaria. And remember, severe malaria is the condition which kills children, where patients have a really high parasite burden. We need to get those parasites down quickly to prevent organ damage. And KE609 obviously has a profile which looks really interesting from that perspective. We're just starting a phase 2 trial in severe malaria. And in addition, we'll also be exploring it to treat normal acute uncomplicated malaria.
Dr. Caroline Bolton, the development head within Novartis, tasked with leading the charge for the next wave of innovative treatments for malaria. An enduring commitment for more than a quarter of a century. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You are back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. I'm Chris Chermak. It's time now for the next installment of our series on Canada's National Party leaders, ahead of a snap federal election which takes place on Monday. Today, Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief, Thomas Lewis, turns his attention to Annamie Paul. She's the leader of the smallest party in Canada's parliament, the Greens.
People in BC are scrambling to find relief from what Environment Canada is calling a dangerous heat wave. An unusually strong
In late June, in the village of Lytton, in the province of British Columbia, Canada's all-time heat record, which had stood since 1937, was toppled over three consecutive days.
On Sunday, June 27th, we hit 46.6 degrees. Monday, June 28th, we hit 47.9. And Tuesday, June the 28th, at the peak of this incredible heat wave, we hit 49.6 degrees Celsius. Just incredible heat. So why does that happen right here in Lytton, British Columbia? There's
a day later, Lytton burned to the ground in a wildfire.
15 minutes after smelling smoke, the entire village was engulfed, according to the mayor. Here is Jen Polderman.
The whole town is on fire. I've ordered the town evacuated, and I've told everyone as I was leaving town to leave.
Of all the issues that have been at play during Canada's snap general election campaign this year, this summer's extraordinary weather in Western Canada has made climate change and its effects a top priority for a large number of voters.
We're at the point, the spear point of climate change, but it's coming for everybody.
You might assume that those events would have presented an opportunity to Canada's Green Party, which was founded in 1983 and which scored its best ever election result the last time Canadians went to the polls back in 2019, when three Green MPs were voted into Parliament. This is how the party's popular then leader, Elizabeth May, responded to those results.
This is the best election result that any Green Party in any first-past-the-post system has ever had. This is the best result ever. And we enter Parliament as the first caucus in the history of our Parliament that is two-thirds women. Just saying.
The Green Party's attention this time around has been focused elsewhere, in on itself. The focus of the party's ire has been on its own leader, Annamie Paul, who's a lawyer and a former advisor to the International Criminal Court in The Hague. She was elected to replace Elizabeth May, who had led the Greens for 13 years, in October last year.
Please join me in congratulating the next leader of the Green Party of Canada, Annamie Paul.
Paul's election to the leadership of the Green Party made history. She's the first black woman and the first Jewish woman to lead a national political party here in Canada. And I spoke to her shortly after her election to the leadership about that achievement for Monocle magazine.
We have got to demonstrate we are ready to govern. I think that there is still some reticence or some suspicion that perhaps we have great ideas, but that we're not professional enough, we're not disciplined enough to be able to execute them. So that is a big part of the role that I have, making sure that people see that we are those things and that our house is in order, so that if they do give us their confidence and a bigger role, we are able to do something impactful with it.
What should have been the beginning of a new era of leadership at the Green Party turned into something quite different quite quickly. Not long after my conversation with Paul, when that opportunity to demonstrate that the Green Party's house was in order came along, it missed its chance.
Hamas, the militant group in control of Gaza, has fired an estimated 2,000 rockets at Israel over the past week, some hitting their mark with devastating effect.
When Anami Paul issued a statement on the escalating violence between the Israeli military and the Palestinian militant group Hamas in May, her party rebelled against her. One of the Greens' three members of parliament defected to the Liberal Party, and moves to oust her from the leadership, which were already underway, re-emerged in earnest.
Federal Green Party leader Anami Paul is firing back following attempts to remove her from the job.
A small group of councillors sought to force a vote of non-confidence in my leadership. They did so with no substantive consultation with the members they represent. They produced a list of allegations that were so racist, so sexist, that they were immediately disavowed.
And there's many people in the Green Party who appear to want to get rid of her. It's been a real omni-shambles of a leadership spill, and certainly not all Anami Paul's fault.
Gary Keller is a political commentator and vice president of the Ottawa-based consultancy Strategy Corps.
There's been a lot of unfortunate actions that have taken place, but it also shows the Greens are just not ready for prime time as a viable political force in Canada.
But Paul has survived those attempts to get rid of her for the time being. And her responses to that campaign to oust her have felt quite different to how internal political wrangles are usually spun and presented to the public by political leaders, as she demonstrated at last week's English language leaders debate in the city of Gatineau.
Being who I am and in this position has been incredibly hard. Being here tonight was not an obvious thing. I've had to crawl over a lot of broken glass to get here. I'm proud to be here. I'm proud to be the first of my kind. And because I am the first of my kind, I know that I won't be the last.
This election may have been a missed opportunity for Canada's Green Party to seize the narrative on its founding issue and to capitalize on its success in the last election 2 years ago. But in the moments that she's been freed from having to talk about her own party's dislike of her, Anami Paul has had the chance to speak for herself. And while it looks likely that that's come too late to translate into votes on election day this time around, many Canadians have indeed liked what they've heard from her.
To every person that is ready to be daring, to every person that is ready to strike out in that new direction towards a better future, I say welcome, I say now is the time, and I say join us. Thank you so much.
For Monocle in Toronto, I'm Thomas Lewis.
Thank you very much, Thomas. For the final installment of our Canadian election series, Thomas will be profiling Maxime Bernier, the provocative leader of the right-wing fringe group, the People's Party of Canada. Be sure to tune in for that tomorrow. You are listening to The Briefing here on Monocle 24. All right, it is time on Thursday for the Global Countdown. Here in the studio with me is Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Faye, welcome.
Hello, Chris.
Good to be here. Did you like my little Arabic lesson at the beginning of the show?
I did. You did have quite a few teasers, as I say, for where we're going this year. I mean, this week, I should say. It's nice to hear. So spoil it for us.
It's an interesting country, Morocco. And of course, we covered Morocco very well here at Monaco about the elections. Very interesting developments. But also, they have a fantastic music scene, I have to tell you. So I think we need to explore what are they listening at the moment.
You were quite excited about this one, I have to say, in preparing this as well. So I'm looking forward to it.
It's very good. And it's not necessarily only Moroccan artists. They're very much Pan-African. We're going to start in number five, actually, with a very popular Algerian singer. He's doing so well in Morocco as well. He's very much associated with social causes. Not with this track, though. I think this track is a little bit more kind of poppy and electronic for his style. Let's have a listen. This is Mo Milano with Dagri Dagri.
Oh. definitely a bit of an infusion there of sort of Arabic pop as well. It's a
lot
nice
of synthesizers
sound.
As well. I like that, you know.
Very nice. And no social or less social causes on this one, but he is somebody who is quite involved, you say.
We might discuss this a bit later in the show, actually, Chris.
Oh, I see.
Spoiler alert. I'm terrible. Actually, I'm not a good person because I always give spoilers to people. But number four, different change of tone. And again, we did, I believe we did Nigeria together very recently here on the Global Countdown. You know, they are doing well all over the world. In fact, this song is from a Nigerian artist. His name is CK. It's called Love in Wantiti. This track is the most Shazam track in the world right now. So, of course, the Moroccans are also enjoying it. It's very clever, amazing Afrobeats. This is, let's have a listen, actually. This is CK. Open up, make I see you. Now you wear the card by fancy. Then they do me a key party. Oh, no, 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 no.
I do remember when we did the Nigerian charts and talking about how they had grown abroad. So it's nice to see the proof of that, if you will, in our charts today.
No, very much so. And he's a great artist. I mean, besides Afrobeats, some people even say that there's some touches of psychedelic pop in his music. I didn't quite notice in that little excerpt that we had. But, you know, it's interesting. Number four.
And interesting to go from sort of north to south of the continent as well, further south. And now we're going to be heading north again.
Absolutely. Same artist, in fact. Mumilan, I told you about the social causes. So this track, Chris, it was released late last year in November. And this one does talk about social causes. I was reading the lyrics. It tells a story about a young boy living in poverty and everything that he has to do to kind of, I don't know, to grow as a kind of a healthy child. You know, even in the video, you can notice that. And it's quite interesting because I think artists, it's nice when they're involved in social causes, as long as they don't become like boring and preachy. But I don't think that's the case of Mumilano. Let's have a listen. A very different tone from his song at number five. This is Mumilano with Maciej Fuhak.
That one does have a nice beat too.
Yeah, he knows how to make a good beat, right? And Chris, just so you know, there's 293 million views for this video on YouTube. I mean, he's massive. Clearly, he's not only in Algeria because they don't even have enough people, you know, to listen that many times to this track as
he
well.
He is clearly going global. It's interesting. Good track.
And if you're missing some Moroccan pop, don't worry. Don't worry. There are Moroccan artists.
I mean, you always want to have something exactly from the actual country. You hope that a local group makes it into the top five.
But this one, I was surprised because when I was listening to it, there's some verses in Portuguese. And then I realized why, because Saad Lengered, he's the main artist for this track, he's from Morocco, one of the biggest names in Moroccan pop, but he also invited the duo from São Tomé e Príncipe, Kalema, which again, they're doing so well all over Africa, which that's quite interesting. I love that it's called Pan-African, this chart is.
So yeah, an interesting collaboration as well.
So it's in Arabic and Portuguese, this track. So Saad Lengered featuring Kalema with Anti Hayati, which means You Are My Life in Arabic. Todos falam de ti.
Na Roma foi bobo que te perdi por tão pouco. I do wonder how many times in the past there have been songs that combine Portuguese and Arabic. It's an interesting mix.
It's amazing. I really love this mixture of countries and different sounds as well, because, you know, clearly when you hear number four, you can see that it's Nigerian kind of Afrobeat. And then you see kind of this Moroccan pop with kind of this slightly Portuguese influenced. Number one, something completely different as well, but from Morocco, actually. He's a very kind of daring artist, I would say, because trap and hip-hop is quite big in Morocco. But this guy, he's first of all, I don't know his face. He's always wearing a mask. He's okay. Always masked.
In videos or any music videos.
Even
he
in
does.
Videos. I'm sure that the tabloids maybe revealed their face in Morocco. But a very interesting guy. His name is Snor. The song is Hakaya, which means a tale. Let's have a listen. أجي نقولك أنا ونحكي لك حكاية دنيا بلادني المجدات دنيا بالهوايا أجي نقولك
Interesting sound. Very, very different from the others, as you said.
Very different, and he's a very clever guy. I mean, people say that he's progressive. I didn't quite understand why they're saying this, but, you know, maybe it's his style. Maybe he's pushing some boundaries with his lyrics as well. I thought this top five was actually quite good.
Very good. Very
well done, Moroccans.
Very different. Yeah. I appreciate that. Fernando, thank you. As always, that was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And that is going to be all the time we have for this edition of The Briefing, produced by Rhys James and Emma Searle. Our researcher today was Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, and our studio manager was Chris Ablakwa. The Briefing will be back tomorrow at the same time. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I am Chris Chermak. Goodbye, and see you tomorrow.